episode 164 Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry. Barry, I just want to say that here in episode 164, we have a brand new listener. Barry, do you know who that is?
A brand new listener, 164. I have no idea who it is.
It is my new rotator cuff. My new rotator cuff is listening to the show for the very first time. Oh, Barry, yes, the old shoulder surgery. It is the year of living dangerously here in the Bowdrin household. First cancer, now the rotator cuff. I'm sure there's somebody out there listening going, fuck, Bowdrin, man, why do you keep talking about all this bad shit that happens to you? I will say, Barry, one of the things about the shoulder surgery is when I go in, what they do is they put like a nerve block on your shoulder, and your basically your entire left side is my left shoulder. The left side of your body basically goes numb for 24 hours. And so I was asking the doctor afterward. I said, so what do you give me here? You give me the old fentanyl or what do you give me? Now, Barry, before I tell you what they gave me, I'm going to guess that when this word comes out of my mouth over the airwaves of whatever, thing you're using, whether it's iTunes, Stitcher, whatever, Barry, Dave Flaherty is getting ready to have an erection. You know why? Because the medicine they gave me for the surgery was the old propofol. Oh, yes, Michael Jackson's best friend. And right now, somewhere in Fort Lauderdale, Dave Flaherty is grabbing the hand cream because when he hears words propofol, you know, beer goes really well with propofol, according to Dave Flaherty. So we are going to have shoulder surgeries, lots of fun, Barry. We're going to have an interesting show today.
Flaherty, good thing Flaherty doesn't listen, right?
Exactly. I'm sure he's a huge fan.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
If he's on the show, yes,
he'll listen, right.
So a little bit of a special show today because we are going to take a look not only at Dave Flaherty's erections, which may be the title of this week's show. I don't know.
Right.
We're going to be looking at the life of a true wrestling legend in some parts. We're going to be talking about Jack Briscoe. Why are we talking about Jack Briscoe? Because the people need to learn. They need to learn about what a great wrestler was, Jack Briscoe, and what a really great guy. And to do so, we're going to talk with Jack's brother Jerry, discussing some of the early days of Jack as a wrestler, how he first got started. I'm talking about when he was still in junior high school, and Jerry's going to tell us some story. We're going to talk with Jerry about a match from Mid-Atlantic. We're talking maybe early summer 1983 as Jack and Jerry Briscoe, the legendary Briscoe brothers, one of the all-time great tag teams, by the way, take on another all-time great tag team in Ricky Steamboat and Jay Youngblood from the old Mid-Atlantic TV show. Where was those taped up, Barry? I think you know the call.
I think it was WRAL in Raleigh, if I'm correct.
Okay. And a terrific match. We're going to be talking with Jerry about that. He's going to give some thoughts, some remembrances about their program with Ricky Steamboat and Jay Youngblood. Besides that, we're going to be looking at, last week we praised the AEW show, Barry. We talked about things that they did that we really liked. Well, this week we're going to be talking about the AEW shows, and I don't think it's going to be quite as praiseworthy as last week's show. Barry, are you ready to get started, my man?
Yeah, I'm so excited to have Jerry Briscoe on this week. And, Jerry Briscoe, I think to a lot of the demographic that listens to our podcast on a weekly basis, Jerry Briscoe is probably best known as one of Vince McMahon's stooges, which really, if you stop and think about it, is a great way to cap off your career because, you know, Jerry started in the late 60s and he had a hell of a career, for some 20 years. But Jerry Briscoe, I can't express how great of a professional wrestler in his heyday he was and how great he and Jack as a tag team were. And you said it, that they really were one of the great tag teams of all time. And they really were. Look, they were tops in Florida. They were tops in Mid-Atlantic. They had a great run in the Federation, WWF. I wish they would have gotten the titles there. But I'll go to my grave. The three best tag teams that I saw were three teams that were facing each other on a nightly basis. And this is the better part of maybe 6 to 8 months. It was the Briscoe brothers, Mike Graham and Steve Kern, and Mr. Saito and Mr. Sato, who later became Kabuki. And these three teams would face each other. And whether it was Graham and Kern versus the Briscoes or the Briscoes versus Saito and Sato, it didn't matter. These three teams, in my opinion, were probably having the best matches in the U.S. at the time. Not just tag team, best professional wrestling matches. They were that good. And, you know, in Florida, these weren't necessarily the headline matches. The headline might have been Dusty Rhodes versus the Spoiler or somebody, you know, whatever. It didn't matter. They stole the show on a nightly basis. But Jeff, I just want to share with you a couple of things about Jerry, because I'm in awe of the guy. First off, I've in some form or another, I've known him for 40 years at this point. But
and, you know, one thing, Barry, before you get into your stories, what a just a fountain of historical wrestling knowledge Jerry Briscoe is. You know, I mean, a guy that, like you said, has been around the business. Whether it's, you know, wrestling in Florida, part of the ownership group in Georgia and the Mid-Atlantic, to his days in the WWF, you know, just a guy that has been around so much wrestling history. And when you sit and, you know, it's like being a kid in class. You just sit there and listen to Professor Briscoe talk about the history of pro wrestling. I interrupted. Please continue.
No, Jeff, you're 100% correct.
Check.
Jerry is one of those guys, and I want to kind of do an addendum to something I've said previously. So I've been saying for years, Jeff, and I think today this is as important now as it ever has been, if not more important. If you ever have a chance to meet your idols, to meet somebody that you've admired, respected, or even liked, you got to fucking do it. As you know, certainly COVID has put everyone's plans on hold. We have seen people that we've admired pass away, whether it was in sports, you know, wrestling or movies, TV, music, doesn't matter. If you have the chance to meet somebody who's had any sort of impact on your life, get in the car and drive and do it. But at the same time, what I want to add to this is Jerry Briscoe needs to write a book. And I've had a conversation with Steve Kern about the same thing. You know, Jerry Briscoe, as you just said, fountain of information, remembers everything going back 50, 55 years. It's incredible. And if this isn't put down on paper, Jeff, this goes back to something you said in print in an episode in a copy of Chair Shots 30 years ago. It's that fried green tomatoes deal. It, you know, you can share these stories verbally, but if you don't get this in print, this could be lost forever. It's got to happen. Encourage people that you like, respect, fucking write the book, do something. But getting back to these stories, two quick stories about Jerry. One is something that'll this, I guess, Jeff, this is off the record. This is between me, you and Lou, because I'm not quite sure. Yeah, I've never talked about this with Jerry. But when Jerry did our fan fest, and Jerry has been a part of two of the fan fests, the first and the third fan fest, he was paired up with Pat Patterson, who is the other stooge in the WWE. And they were, you know, these two guys, hey, they're the best of friends. They just had so much fun together. But it had come to light just a few days before the event that one of our members in the group and somebody that we're both friendly with, his daughter was facing real serious health issues. And she had been back in the hospital. I believe she was on a respirator. She unfortunately subsequently has passed. And we're talking about somebody in her early to mid 20s. So it's a really sad story. Well, Jerry had seen the post where we were wishing this gentleman, you know, that we were all in his corner when it came to his daughter. And Jerry pulls me aside at the end of the event. We pay all of our talent and cash at the end of the night. And he said, "Where's the guy whose daughter is really sick?" And he took 50% of what we had paid him and handed it to this guy to take care of his daughter. And there was no fanfare made on this. There was no, you know, we didn't make a big deal for the obvious. It's a private thing. That's why I'm not mentioning names otherwise. But, you know, what does that say to you? Like that is just unbelievable that he did that. You know, I wasn't aware that he had even read that post. And for him to do that, was just unbelievable. And every time I talk to the guy, he'll always bring that up to me. And I just think it's just so incredible. The second aspect is one thing we've done at 5 of the 6 Fan Fest, Jeff, is we have inducted people into the CWF Hall of Fame. CWF Hall of Fame is very similar to maybe the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame in that I go to people that are quote unquote historians that understand the promotion. I get a ballot and then we publicly post it and we let people vote. So, the Briscoe brothers are in twice, Jerry and Jack, both as singles and then also as a tag team. So we decided that since we had Jerry at this event, that we were going to do the official introduction, the official induction into the Hall of Fame. And I got to tell you, it was probably the most moving speech that anyone has ever given. And I'm going to this is where the respect for Jerry Briscoe really comes into play, because again, we respect him based off of what we've seen in the ring. The guy was a solid wrestler, beyond. He was arguably one of the best. But as a human being, his speech that night sent goosebumps up and down my arms. And I believe this was recorded and I want to find it. Do you know who he thanked when it came time for the Hall of Fame? He thanked the fans, Jeff. And do you know why? Because he said, we can go into a Hall of Fame, and a lot of these Hall of Fames are dictated strictly by either sports writers, people who know sports writers, or maybe the owners of the organization. You know, with the WWE, their Hall of Fame, it's decided by Vince, and I'm assuming his son-in-law, maybe his daughter and his son. But this is not something that people are voted on, and that's a completely different subject. He thanked the fans, he said, because when I was in wrestling, if I ever won a title or Jack ever won a title, that was determined in an office. You know, he basically said, you know, pro wrestling, it's worked. We all know it at this stage. And he said, you know, the promoters or the bookers decided the titles we got. Being into a Hall of Fame where the fans vote you in means more than anything. The fans who came to see us for a decade or longer, the fans who paid money on a nightly basis to come see us, the fact that you would recognize us in this way means more than any other award that we can receive. And when he said that, I stood there and he got choked up and he had tears coming out of his eyes. And a lot of it had to do with not only the recognition of his career, Jeff, but the recognition of his late brother's career. That meant everything to me. You know, that those words resonated and it made me understand at that moment that, look, we do a Hall of Fame, but there's no brick and mortar building to this. You know, this is just, it's virtual. This is something that people essentially give their opinions on. But I never understood the importance of how much that meant to somebody that was inducted. And when Jerry was choked up talking about how much Jack meant to him, and Jerry probably talked for 20 minutes. It was also I should have teased him or ribbed him about it, but it was probably the longest at 20 or 25 minutes, the longest induction speech we ever had, but how much it meant to him. And, you know, when we hand somebody the microphone as the acceptance, we don't know what we're going to get. You know, Jerry could have easily said, thank you. This is a great honor. You know, let's sign some more autographs. And he didn't do that. Instead, he talked about the importance of the ticket buyer to his career, the importance of the fan that supported he and his brother throughout his career. And that right there is the most justification, the most important justification for the Hall of Fame, at least in my eyes, Jeff.
Very, very eloquently spoken, Barry. And I will also encourage you, if you were out there on Twitter, Jerry Briscoe, a great Twitter follow. He does these videos now. He's been doing them for about the last, 4 or 5 weeks, where he comes on and he says, yeah, I have a special announcement that's going to shock the wrestling world. And he'll, each video is maybe a minute and a half long. And he'll go into this long preamble about what he's about to say. And just when he gets to the point where he's going to make the big reveal, he's like, oh, I'm sorry, I'm out of time. I'll bring it up next week. And he keeps teasing that he's got this big reveal. It's very funny. And on that note, Barry, why don't we go to our interview now with the great Jerry Briscoe? Hey, Barry, we are very, very happy to be joined, since we're discussing Jack Briscoe, to be, you know, joined by somebody who I think, you know, Barry, I'm guessing here, he may know a little bit about Jack's history. I don't know. Hey, it's brother Jerry. Jerry Briscoe, how you doing, my man?
Oh, I'm doing wonderful. Great to be on you guys' show, man. You guys are Florida legends.
Well,
now you're out with the internet, you're global legends. Who would have thought? Who would have thought a guy with all that hair back when he was a kid, you know, would be taking pictures with all of us, and now be hosting all of us on global podcasting, whatever that was.
Barry, I can tell you, without any uncertainty, if you would have told me as a 12 and 13-year-old, and Jerry, I don't know if you remember this, I was wrestling in junior high, and you at one point actually were giving me tips on wrestling, on amateur wrestling, going back to my youth. So it's a big deal. But if you would have asked me 40 years ago, yeah.
I hope you won that match.
wait. Was Jerry giving you tips on how to shoot on these kids in high school tournaments?
He was saying, this is what you need to do. Don't worry about it. But yeah, I remember specifically you said, what's your favorite takedown? And of course, you know, I think my response was something like fireman's carry or something to that effect. But I never forgot that because, hey, you know, as Jeff will tell you, your brother and yourself were both heroes to us. There's no getting around this. You know, a lot of people grew up, you know, in big cities with a lot of sports. And I think Florida, Jeff, was very unique in the fact that, yes, we had the Miami Dolphins. Collegiate sports have been around forever in the state of Florida, but wrestling was the one constant that 51 weeks out of the year, I knew on a Wednesday night at 8 o'clock where I was going to be, Jeff.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things that I've discussed with people is, you know, a few years back before we lost your brother, Jack, I had a chance to go out to CAC, Jerry, and it was the first time I'd ever had a chance to actually meet and sit down and chat with your brother. And, you know, I always said that when you're a young kid and you have a childhood hero, and then later in your life, as you become an adult and you meet that hero, a lot of times you're disappointed. And I was very, very happy to say that your brother absolutely did not disappoint me. He was a hero that I found had met my standards and exceeded them as an adult. And one of the coolest things that ever happened in my life was the next day when we were going to the airport to fly back to our homes. And I saw your brother and his wife, and I walked up to him and said hello. And he looked at me and he said, "Oh, hey, Jeff, how you doing?" And I'm like, "Wow, fucking Jack Briscoe remembered my name. That is just like the coolest thing ever." So we wanted to talk about your brother Jack and yourself. First of all, I want to start off with there is a great video out there on YouTube called "This Is Your Life, Jack Briscoe" that recently popped up there. So you know, and it's a really for a thing that aired on CWF. It was remarkably true to life about some of the things that your brother had gone through, and he showed some pictures of his days in college. So let's start off from your brother's high school days, and of course, we'll get into your career also. Your brother in high school and college, how did he when he first got into the on the mat? Was he immediately like just this legend, or was it something that he slowly developed to? What do you remember about your brother in his high school and college days?
Well, first of all, This Is Your Life, it was put together, it was originally a program to get Jack ready for a world title match against Dory Funk Jr. And Milo Steinborn, or Dickie Steinborn, Milo's son, put that together. And they later put it into a video form from the book. And I believe in that early original, might have been one of the first vignettes of a wrestler buildup, and probably one of the best wrestler buildup taped. And it was played, it was shipped around the United States, which was totally unheard of at that time. But Eddie Graham, as you know, had a lot of political power, and Eddie was able to get his way with a lot of things. Plus, it was such a tremendously produced deal. I think that's where Florida Championship Wrestling was so far ahead of a lot of promotions that Eddie had those visions like that to do that stuff, some of the stuff we did. But that wasn't your question. The question was with Jack, and when he started, Jack was a basketball player, you know, and in middle school. Now, you know, the ninth grade, you're in high school. But the seventh to ninth grade when we were in school was junior high school. And Jack was a basketball and a football star and a track star. Jack, a little be known, Jack was like a district champion and I think regional champion high jumper. He could high jump over 6 foot. So Jack was just one of those natural athletes. So he entered a tournament in the ninth grade, an intramural wrestling tournament. And mind you, Blackwell, Oklahoma, I mean, they you go back in the record books, they've produced national champions, Olympic champions, and every type of wrestling champion you can imagine. So winning any kind of a tournament in that school system was big. So Jack entered the intramural wrestling tournament. And he ended up pinning the two-time champion, and the high school coach was just, you know, the most high school coaches do. He was out scouting for potential guys, and the Blackwell had a returning heavyweight named was Kenny Allwhite, who was like a two-time state runner-up and had been beat by this guy in Tulsa. So he saw Jack and he talked Jack and coming out the next year for high school wrestling instead of basketball. Cause he told Jack, you know, you're average height and you know, in wrestling, you know, I can probably get you a scholarship if you develop a way. So the credit was to the wrestling coach at high school, coach, Chuck Ketrick, who was an outstanding wrestler in the NCAA tournament for Oklahoma State University and national champion. So, Jack went to his best friend Bill McDaniels and talked to Bill, and Bill said, Jack, if you'll go out for it, I wanted to try it, and I'm not a good basketball player either, so let's give it a shot. So they both went out, and they turned out to be state champion. But the third match that Jack had, he almost dropped out of wrestling and quit because he didn't like getting beat. And I, like I said, the guy that was Jack had to challenge for make the team was a state runner up the previous year, and only lost to this one guy from Tulsa. So Jack worked hard and defeated that state runner up, the defending letterman for Blackwell, and made the team. Well, his first two matches went well. He won. And then his third match as a sophomore year in high school, this guy, the returning state champion from Tulsa, had beaten our guy. Jack got beat by him. And as that turned out, that was the only defeat in Jack's career. From then on out, Jack had the determination, I'm never going to get beat again. So Jack didn't get beat again. He pinned everybody, I think, his junior and senior year in high school, and then won an all-state football player. So yeah, he was a pretty fair athlete in high school. He was like an instant star after that first defeat. But those first defeats humble a lot of guys. I've seen it throughout my lifetime, my career. Somebody gets beat, they take two paths. Either they bow their head and walk off the mat and never return, or they go back to the wrestling room and work their butts off and become a star. And that's what Jack decided to do.
Well, and Jerry, too, we shouldn't leave out. You guys came from a fairly large family there, 4 boys, 2 girls, Lovett Junior High School. But you, sir, also, you placed first in the state championships in the 140-pound weight class. Was that the same year that Jack was going off to college?
Yes, it was. It was. I got trouble with dates and putting all that together. That's a long time ago. But yeah, Jack was going off to college, and then the next year, even it still goes on today. When families, especially wrestlers, it seems like, it's a family sport. You know, usually if you have an older brother wrestling, he's practicing at home, beating the hell out of you every day. You know, so,
younger, I can attest to that.
So I got kind of used to that, and I got, you know, where I could sometimes, like, I can't say I'd beat Jack, but sometimes I get lucky, get a takedown on him, and And once we got to college, the college coach really liked putting me with Jack because other guys were kind of intimidated by my brother Jack. And he knew if I was on the mat with Jack, I wouldn't back down because it was my brother. I knew he wasn't going to kill me, you know, because he'd have to face my mom afterwards. So one day I met I think in college workouts, right before a big match, I think it was against those damn Sooners of OU.
I was not going to bring up last night's game. That's all I'm going to say.
Well, I didn't, and you did. You already have already, so I'm going to go, guys. So anyway, where was I? Coach Roderick put, he said, Briscoe, get out there and get your brother. So I made the mistake of embarrassing Jack and taking his butt down and putting him on his back. And, you know, and boy, the wrestling room just got quiet as soon as the coach broke us up, stood us up. And probably one of the biggest mistakes I made in my collegiate wrestling career was taking my brother down and putting him on his back so quick. And Jack proceeded to just kick my butt. He blacked my eye, bloodied my lip. And, Back in the 60s, you know, wrestling didn't have a lot of scholarship. They still don't have a lot of scholarship. So I got, because I was a local kid, like I was saying before, a lot of wrestling families, you know, if the older brother college scholarship, the rest of the family moved to the college town so they could watch them wrestle. So Coach Ryder got my mom a job at Oklahoma State University at the Postal Department. So we moved up there. So I had to move to Stillwater. So anyway, back to the practice match, Jack just totally beat the crap out of me. And I went home with a black eye, bloody lip. My mom took a look at me and said, what happened to you? I said, your damn son. And I couldn't use the word damn in front of my mom. She proceeded to browbeat me down after I'd already been physically beaten up by my brother. And she got mad at Jack and called Jack. Why are you doing that to your brother? Why you took me down? You know, I mean, we had a little family feud over it. But you know what? I went back the next day and I tried my best. And he knew I was coming for him. And I wasn't able to take him down that the rest of that week.
So well, let me ask Jerry. When the time came for Jack to go into the pro ranks and stuff like that, tell us who was it that made that initial reach out to Jack to say to gauge his interest in pro wrestling. I mean, I know that you guys were fans and stuff, having read Jack's book, but who was the initial person that reached out to Jack about possibly having a pro career?
Well, as the wrestling coach at Oklahoma State, and you read his book, so people that did read his book, I'm kind of repeating that. But Jack originally signed a football scholarship to Oklahoma University to play football there, and for the damn Sooners. So Myron Roderick, the wrestling coach at OSU, wanted Jack so bad that, you know, like most coaches do, they did a lot of research. He found out that Jack's lifelong dream was to be a professional wrestler. And Danny Hodge was the hero. Of course, Danny Hodge was a Sooner, so he couldn't really have Hodge go talk him into going out for wrestling. He might have talked him into going to OU and doing wrestling and football both. So Leroy McGurk, who was the promoter in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and everybody knew Leroy. He was a national champion at Oklahoma State also, Oklahoma A&M at the time. And so he was the local promoter. He was also a world junior heavyweight champion. And he was the main booker for Hodge. So Roderick called over to Tulsa and had told Leroy the story that he got this great kid out of Blackwell that loved professional wrestling, and he's just signed a football scholarship. But, you know, he knew he could make him into a national champion, and he wanted to be a pro wrestler, and told McGurk he'd be a great prospect for him down the road. So McGurk said, you tell that boy as soon as he finishes there, wins you a national championship, that he got a contract waiting for him. So, of course, Roderick called Jack. Jack said, yeah, a lot of coaches tell me that. Well, the phone calls went back and forth. Finally, one day, in our yard, Leroy McGurk the Kentuckians, which was Big Boy Brown and Grizzly Smith and an old shooter wrestler by the name of Jack Gott, who was a referee in one of Leroy's eyes, because Leroy, as you guys know, was blind. So he was the main referee and the kind of the eyes and ears for Leroy and the guy that made all the live shows. So they drove over to Blackwell on the way to a little spot show town. And so here's the three big professional wrestlers that come to our home. They come right up to the door and they bring Leroy, you know, we're all introduced to them. And Leroy looked at Jack and said, Jack, give you my word. If you'll go to Oklahoma State and wrestle, as soon as you get through and you win a national championship, I'll put you in the ring. So Jack had changed his mind. They called Roderick, and Roderick was there within an hour. So it was only like an hour and a half away from Blackwell. And I think Roderick broke the speed record getting there in about 45 minutes. I had the paperwork and had my mom and Jack sign it. And we were off to Stillwater. And, you know, and Jack, and that's kind of how he got reached out to. And then less than 2 months later, he won the national championship in March. And I think he debuted in Oklahoma City at the Stockyards Coliseum, which was, you know, the place in Oklahoma to wrestle was the Stockyards Coliseum. And less than 2 months after he won a national title, they already had Jack in the ring working full-time as a professional wrestler. So there wasn't any of this big, you know, NXTs and all these big training camps and all this stuff. It was, hey, kid, here's a ring, Jack. Go over to Tulsa about once a week on the weekends. Go to the Canes Ballroom where they had the ring set up and work out with guys like Jack Gott, Spud Monroe, Red McKim, Joe McCarthy, and a lot of other guys that Leroy had around to help him out. In less than 2 months, they had him match ready, and he debuted on TV. And his first match on TV was against who? You guys know?
I do.
Terrible
it was, yeah, Ronnie June Garvin. 5th. No, Terry Garvin.
Oh, Terry Garvin, yeah.
Yep, June 5th, 1965 in Oklahoma City.
Ronnie was the first one. What date was that?
It was June 5th, 1965.
Well, they waited. They got a little bit longer to put him on TV, but March he wrestled in the Stockyards Coliseum, I think, for his first match. I don't know against who, but. I think it was March. Well, I think you posted a paper clipping on it one time on your Facebook page.
Yeah, I did. And I pulled this up because it's interesting. Everything you were saying was dead on and spot on, because I've got a copy of that Milo's Mat that Dick Steinborn put out. And, it's, you know, it's beyond informative. And as I was going through that last night in preparation for talking to you today, a lot of the images that we saw on that Jack Briscoe, This Is Your Life special that aired on television were directly coming from this Milo's Mat. But I did pull that Jack's first match was against Terry Garvin on June 5th, 1965. And there's so much information in this, and we're going to be posting this back on Facebook over the coming days so that people can see it. So, Jerry, were you there when Jack made his pro debut?
I wasn't at the TV match, but I was at the Stockyards Coliseum, and that's the first time I got to meet Danny Hodge in person. You know, funny story. Back in those days, you know, they had all kinds of animals touring, you know. So Hyde was the guy that they always put against the bear, you know, because Hyde wasn't afraid of no bear, and that bear was definitely in a more appropriate audience. I could tell a funny story about Hyde than that bear, but I can't tell it to a mixed audience here. But I tried to get to Oklahoma City and see all of Jack's matches. Of course, I couldn't. And I was so lucky, you know, when Jack started, you know, a spring break was just right around the corner. So I would go on road shows with Jack while I was still in school during spring break and the holiday system, you know, just to get out of Stillwater and have something to do. I'd go on a road trip with Brother Jack.
So, Jerry, before we, you know, we're talking about your brother Jack and your career. Before we do, since you brought up his name, and you know, years have gone by since he was such a great professional. Can you possibly convey to our audience, and we do have some younger listeners, just what a huge, huge deal the great Danny Hodge was, especially in his home state of Oklahoma?
Well, I mean, in the home state of Oklahoma, I mean, Danny Hodge, there's probably three athletes that, you know, they're different generational athletes, but these three were my generation. And in this order to me, because I was a wrestler, it was Danny Hodge, Mickey Mantle, and Jim Thorpe. And those were three idols in Oklahoma. Every kid you grew up idolizing Jim Thorpe, you know, because, you know, 90% Oklahoma at that time was Native American, and Jim Thorpe being the great Olympian and the great athlete that he was. You know, of course, him, then Mickey Mantle, you know, the Yankees and Mickey Mantle and Commerce, Oklahoma, was about 80 miles from my hometown, you know, and Hodge, who, had, you know, was Olympian and a undefeated national champion. So
we Golden Gloves boxer too.
Yeah. Yeah. And I go to first only to win a national championship the same year in boxing and wrestling. So we had some pretty good role models to look up to, you know, and plus, like I said, our small town where wrestling was king in the surrounding areas. We had probably a half dozen or so Olympic champions just living in that little small area of rural Oklahoma.
Yeah. So, you know, we've talked about the early parts of Jack's
career. Jeff, I wanted to ask, Jerry, just because this really is pertaining. So, Jerry, for many years with the WWE, you were the talent scout. One of the guys that you actually kind of discovered, another guy from Oklahoma, is Jake Hager, who has not only had great success in professional wrestling, but also MMA fighting, where I think he's doing extremely well from everything that I understand. So one of the things that people always say about Danny Hodge, obviously that great tendon strength, can crush an apple with his hands, can rip phone books and do all these things. You knew Danny Hodge. You've worked with Danny Hodge many times. How would Danny Hodge have fared in MMA fighting?
God, I get asked that question so much, and my answer is always the same. You know, at preparation, there are so many styles that go into MMA, and those guys are so skilled. But, you know, becoming good friends with a lot of the guys, you know, the Daniel Cromiers and the Crute, there's so many of them from Oklahoma State, you know, that are champions. So I've got to know a few of them and their mindset. And their mindset in combat sports is probably the most important thing you have. You just got to have that mindset that you don't care about humanity. You're going to go through it, you know. And Hodge had as sweet a guy, and anybody that's ever been around Hodge, he's the sweetest guy, nicest guy you'll ever want to meet. But he also has that mentality where he could flip that switch and be a madman like these guys are now. I think Hodge is the prototype. You go back and you look at perfect athletes and how they should be built for combat sports, and the mentality part of it. Danny Hodge fits in both of those categories right up at the top of the ladder.
I've always thought that when you talk about the possibility of someone like Danny Hodge in any kind of combat sports or MMA, like you combine his amateur background, which is fantastic, the fact that he was, you know, Golden Gloves boxer, and then when you throw in that third equation, which is that tendon strength, folks, he could break a pair of pliers, okay?
And he many times.
Yeah, and just incredible tennis. If Hodge got his hands on you, it was over. That's as simple as that. I don't mean to get off on a tangent here on Danny Hodge, although I could talk for
a guys by wrist, 300 pounders, you know, football players, you know, from OU back, you know, used to want to come and meet the great Danny Hodge and see if he's really as strong as they want to. Of course, when Watts was there, Watts used to bring all those guys in just to laugh at them. I mean, you know, they'd be All-American, three-time All-American football players, you know, 6'5", 300-pound Watts friends, you know, Watts size friends. Watts would bring them by and then just kind of ribbed at it. Hey, Danny, this guy thinks he can take you. And then he'd just get that little giggle on him, that little grin, that little sparkle in his eye, grab your hand, and with the other hand, he'd just grab your wrist or your elbow, and he'd start squeezing. And you could see the fear and the pain in these big old boys' eyes as they start wilting down to their knees. When Danny get them that way, is this convincing enough? And he'd, please let go, Mr. I thought many.
So, well, listen, before, you know, before we have a limited time with Jerry today, before we let him go, we wanted to talk with Jerry about, we picked out a match of the week, and the match that we picked out this week is Jack and Jerry on Mid-Atlantic TV. You guys had kind of started to go a little bit against the fans, which was, you know, very contrary to both you and Jack's whole careers. And you faced the great tag team of Ricky Steamboat and Jay Youngblood on Mid-Atlantic TV. Barry, first of all, you had a chance to watch this match. Tell the folks what you thought of this match.
Yeah, this is a great match, too. So I'm going to go to my grave, and I think two of the best matches that we have reviewed on our podcast, I think this is going to be one of them. I got to tell you, Jeff, I'm kind of blowing the curve with this one right now. I think my favorite tag match was the Briscoe brothers versus Adonis and Murdoch, because 3 years later, I'm still talking about this match. I just think it's out of control. But this one is great because, you know, in wrestling, there's this contrast. You know, when I first saw Abdul the Butcher, when he first came to Florida, he was put into a feud with Jerry. And that's a big contrast of styles right there. Jerry was a wrestler, still is a wrestler. And Abdullah was, you know, more of a gimmick guy, you know, it was more the blood and guts and pulling out a pencil and things like that. But Steamboat Youngblood and Briscoe's, there's a lot of similarities there. Physically, there's a lot of similarities. But from a wrestling standpoint, a lot of similarities. I love this match. You know, for me, professional wrestling has always been about the second part of that word. It's always been about wrestling. My favorites were always guys who were actually wrestlers. So I thought this was great. David Crockett states the obvious right here. You're seeing two of the best teams anywhere. Youngblood's backdrops, Jeff, I don't know if you picked this up, but he takes a couple of backdrops here and honestly looks like he's about 9 or 10 feet in the air. Just incredible. But I really like this finisher because, you know, the Briscoe brothers at this point were essentially, if they weren't full out heels, they were certainly on their way, and Jerry has got Steamboat, who has an injured knee in the figure four. Youngblood comes over, and while he's got Steamboat in the figure four, he schoolboys Youngblood.
That was great.
Like, I mean, you know, you don't really see this too often. We would never really saw this too often, especially from a heel. So I like the fact, you know, that these were wrestling heels. This wasn't just a full-out heel. These were wrestling heels. I thought that was great. The referee then gets Youngblood out of the ring. Jack Briscoe shoots off the ropes and does a splash onto the knees. The referee calls for a disqualification. Tommy Young, I don't know why you would call for a disqualification on that. Jack and Jerry then exit the ring, and Jack stops by, and I think it's either Tony or David Crockett, and he says, how do you like that for a bald eagle now? Because they had been referring to Jack as the bald eagle. I just thought this was great. This was so much fun. I think it's only, what, Jeff, 11 minutes or so?
Yeah, exactly. It's right up there in the Barry Rose time limit spectrum. You know,
the Barry Rose ADD, can't stay focused for too long. It's absolutely right in my wheelhouse. But I love this match. Jerry, big question for you. You didn't do a lot. You know, I know when you went out to Amarillo, you guys were sometimes thought of as the heels because of the Funk Brothers. Obviously, Mid-Atlantic, you did work as heels. Was there any consideration at any point given to you working in Florida as heels? Now, of course, I was there ringside for all the matches you had against Mike Graham and Steve Kern, which essentially was the two most popular babyface tag teams in the state. But you and Jack were very subtle heels. And when I say that, the crowd was really evenly split. But at the same time, was there any consideration at any point to turn you guys heel?
Well, first of all, Eddie Graham hated the idea that we would even attempt to be heels, but during that time frame, we were kind of in a flux of having somebody, a heel team for Mike and Steve to work with, because they'd gone through so many guys. And so Mike really wanted to work with Jack and I. As always, he really wanted to work with us. So we sat down with Mike together. I think the first time we talked about it was actually in Miami, on one of those plane rides home. What could we do? But our whole philosophy with this thing here was not to be a heel, but to be a smart wrestling heel. Like you say, the key word being wrestling, and just go on the phrase that, hey, we're wrestlers, we know how to wrestle, and you can't beat us. And Hodge told me at an early age, you're a wrestler. That's your gimmick. You don't have a gimmick. Your gimmick is you're a wrestler. Don't ever let anybody out wrestle you. And Jack had that philosophy too. So with Eddie, like I said, Eddie hated the deal. So he let us just kind of tease the public, and it got to, in a couple of places, and Miami was one, Jacksonville was really one, where people really started, turning on Jack and I. And Eddie really didn't like that because, Eddie groomed Jack for the world championship and all that. So he was protecting his property. And so that was the closest we got to it. And it was so much fun. Steve Kern and I today, we still talk about it, laugh about it, and Steve, one time we were wrestling down in the Caribbean, one of those islands we used to go to all the time down there. He was always scared to death. Mike did wrestle a little bit, but he wasn't in any way, shape, or form, and our level, not bragging or anything, but, truth is truth. And Steve knew that he wasn't. So he was scared to death that when any time Jack and I would snap, and go Hodge on him and stretch him out. So one time we're in an island, and Steve goes to lock up to me. Well, Steve, believe it or not, Steve's not the most coordinated guy in the world in the ring. I went down, knocked me. As he took a step forward, I was down. He stepped on my hand and broke my damn hand at the same time. So I'm knocked out and my hand broke. I don't know where to grab or what to sell, But he grabbed hold on and we ended up finishing the match. But back to Carolina. But that was about as far as we got. Just a little tease with Eddie and the fans out. And the fans really enjoy it. And they still talk about the semi-turn that we had today. So that's the reason it was such a big shock when we went to the Carolinas. We used the same philosophy up there that we weren't going to be out wrestled, but we did something really novel, and especially in today's business, we made the title actually mean something in that feud. It was, Jack and I were probably the only wrestlers ever confident enough to admit that, hey, we're getting toward the end of the career, but you know what? There's one title that we've never held, and that's the World Tag Team Championship. And up until that time, we had never held it. So Ricky and Jay were just coming off of this huge, successful run with Don Cardoodle and
Sergeant Slaughter.
Slaughter.
Yeah.
And it was a wild run, and they drew record crowds everywhere. So they needed somebody to work with, and they were looking around, it was all repeats. Well, we'd go back to Anderson, or we'd go back to these guys or whatever. And Ricky and Jack and I and Jay, we were all really tight friends. And so we were making a car ride back from Raleigh one time, and we kind of devised this little plan on how we could do it, with the storyline. This is one title the Briscoes have never had, and we're getting up there in our age, where it's time to either win it or get out of the ring. So We had time and convincing Jimmy Crockett. Once again, it was one of those deals. Jimmy ran three towns a night. I don't know if people knew that, but they booked three towns a night out of Carolina. He needed baby faces. And Jack and I were two of the most steady baby faces. That was the 80s. We'd started in there in the 70s. So we were probably the most consistent baby faces that they had. So Jimmy Crockett, he was like, Eddie, I hate it. You know, it'll never work. And plus, I just can't afford to lose baby faces. And so we kept on Jimmy. And I think we finally convinced him. And, you know, with the caveat that we wasn't going to turn full bore heel there. We were just going to, you know, just tell the people, hey, we've never had this title. You got two guys or two young guys that really don't deserve this thing. You know, who better, you know, ex-world champion, ex-junior heavyweight world champion, but someone never been as a tag team champ, world tag team champion. So, and we'd always tell them, we're not breaking any rules. I know every rule in the book. You know, I was a cocky little brother. And I know we know every rule in the book. We know how to, we know we got a 10 count. We know we got a 5 count. And we would stretch that and stretch it. And when we did stretch it, all we would do after we do it and strike on Young Bud or Steamboat, we'd just turn to the audience and kind of smile like, see, we told you, we're not breaking rules. And you idiots out there in Carolina, you think we're breaking rules. And this thing, it got over, man. And first of all, I think Jay Youngblood is probably one of the most underrated baby faces ever to work the Carolinas. This kid, he was really the glue that kept the four of us together. He was so bright and figures and angles, you know, that we would go, Jay, how can we get this spot in, you know, and still be true to the form that we, the story that we want to tell in the ring. And it was usually Jay that was working things out. And between the two of them, they were just so smooth. It was almost like a mirror image of each other when we're in the ring. It had the same chemistry, I believe, as the Briscoes and the Funks.
Nice. That's a really high praise for somebody like Jay Youngblood, and I would certainly agree. So I know that we have a very limited window. I have two final questions for you. The first one is, you know, when you're a world champion, the way that your brother Jack was, and he had about a 2-year run, how is it after you've had that world title run, like, I hate to put it this way, but almost like from an ego point of view, to accept going back and working on cards in the state of Florida, where you're going to, you know, while you're going to St. Pete and you're going to Miami and Jacksonville, you're going to bigger towns, but you're also making those spot shows where all of a sudden now you're not the world champion anymore. Maybe you're in a tag team match or you're just in a singles match, maybe middle of the card or semi-main event or something like that. How did your brother Jack handle going from being world champion back to being a guy on the card? Now, and I don't mean to, you know, say that Jack was not as great as he always was, but I mean, do you understand what I'm saying?
Yes, I do. And that's a great question. And those of us, those out there that were privileged enough to know Jack, when Jack called a spot when he was ready to drop it. I mean, the NWA did call Jack and say, Jack, it's time for you to vacate the world championship. Jack, Eddie, I've had enough of this. I want out. Call the Funks, call Ray's, call anybody you want to. This is it. I'm finished. He was starting a new marriage, and he just didn't. You know, he'd already been through two, and he didn't want this one to be a failure. You know, so he called the time out. He called the time, and he basically, they worked that gimmick. Well, okay, kind of like the Funks, only reverse, where Dory was supposed to be the guy, but Dory couldn't make it. And then Dory, I guess, had a habit of not making those world title matches. But I won't get into that.
That's very subtle.
Marty will get mad at me, call me and you guys both, and chew us all out. So,
you will.
I talk to Terry about once a week, by the way, and I love my conversation with Terry. So, but Jack, when Jack finally, he picked that night, Jack was, in all essence, you know, for him, was going to retire. And so Jimmy Crockett, Jack, if you go back, well, Jack didn't even take bookings. I mean, you want to what? And he turned down, I mean, you guys would, you know, back in tens of thousands of dollars to go back to Japan. And Jack, hey, I'm finished. When he dropped that title, he took a watch off and he didn't put it back on until we went up to Vince for that Adonis and Murdoch angle there. So, Jack had no problem with it. Jack was, you know, we're fortunate where we own percentages of Florida Championship and Georgia Championship. So Jack knew what his value was at that time, and that was take guys like Bob Orton Jr., Dick Slater, Don Morocco, and work with these guys and build them up and make them bigger stars than what they were at the time, and getting that Jack Briscoe rub. And with Bob Orton Jr., I mean, Jack loved Bobby Jr. because we're friends with the old man, Bob Sr. So he took Bobby Jr. down there and put the Florida title on him. That was one of the biggest shocks to Florida title I'd ever seen when Jack dropped the belt to him. But that was Jack's call, too. So Jack knew what he wanted to be. So Crockett needed some help up in Carolina, so he called Jack, and Jack went up there. And at that time, I would kind of, you know, we'd done the deal with Mike and Steve. We'd done the deal. And, you know, we'd been here for years, almost 20 years. And so I was needing a change in my personal way of life. And so Georgia Championship as well, also on Stock End, was opening up Ohio, Michigan, West Virginia. And I wanted eventually to be in the office. So I figured that was my chance. So I called Barnett, worked out a deal where I became the promoter of those three states for Georgia Championship Wrestling. I was the front man, and I'd go up and set up the shows and do all the promotional work and all that. And so I was kind of not working, and then Jack went to Carolina, and of course got over, and they were going, well, yeah, how about your brother? Well, he come back, and Jack said, well, he's happy doing the promotion in Doorbell. I called him, so Jack called me, and I said, yeah, I'd like to go up. And that's when we went up and became the heels against Ricky and Jay.
Gotcha. Well, Jerry, we do want to be respectful of your time. You've got a big day of football viewing ahead of you. I have one final question. It actually is not wrestling related whatsoever, but in the last 50 years, and it's over 50 years, I think it's 52 years, you have literally traveled the world either as a professional wrestler or as an employee of the WWE. If I said to you, Jerry, I've got a plane, the plane is fueled, I am buying dinner, where are we going, Jerry? What is your favorite restaurant in the entire world that you've actually been to?
Wow. Wow. Well, there are some places. Back when I was young, I was fortunate. I went to Australia. And during those Australian trips, about once a month, we would go like to Hong Kong, Bangkok, Singapore with Barnett. So I became friends with, I'm a kid out of college, and I become really good friends with King Curtis and Mark Lund. And they were Jim Barnett disciples. Barnett loved them to death. So we're in Hong Kong. And so when we'd sold out this little, this soccer stadium in Hong Kong, and Jim was feeling good about the show. We had like two or three straight nights in Hong Kong, all three of them. And he come to Lou, and he said, Marky boy, hey, take you and the King out to dinner tonight. And Dad made plans with me, so we're going to go out to one of these places that only Lou and Curtis know about in Hong Kong, you know. And that's something I can't say on a family show. So they said, well, we got a kid with us too. Well, he's welcome to come along with too. So we went up on top of this building in Hong Kong. And I couldn't even tell you the name of it because it's some Chinese name, but we went up there. I'd had food. I'm a little country boy from Oklahoma. I had a big trip to me was going to Manhattan, Kansas, you know, on the Big Eight. And so I'm in Hong Kong. I'm on top of this damn skyscraper and with this millionaire, and they buy us dinner. And we get one of the greatest Oriental meal I ever had in my life. But that would probably be it. Plus, is just the friendship and the ambiance and looking out at Hong Kong below us. So it was an experience I had in my mind that I'll never forget, and one that I value a lot. But yeah, I'm a Cracker Barrel guy. You know, I love Cracker Barrel.
they have great country biscuits and cornbread. There's no disputing that.
That's it. So
well, listen.
I'm easy.
Okay, Jerry. Last thing for you. It's not so much a question as I'm asking you to retell something. I was very fortunate, as I have regaled the audience before, that I was very lucky to go out and have dinner on more than a few occasions with some of the legends of wrestling. And Jerry was one of the first guys that we had dinners with down in South Florida. Jerry, I don't know if you remember the South Florida Smart Marks. And we went to a great Brazilian steakhouse. And so we were peppering Jerry with questions throughout the evening. And the greatest Jerry Briscoe story that he told was when we were talking, because, of course, the host for the evening was Dan Lambert, a guy that's very involved with UFC and MMA. And so we were talking about tough guys and who's a tough guy. Is this guy a tough guy? Was this guy a tough guy? And then we asked Jerry Briscoe, Jerry, I don't know if you remember this. We said, Jerry, what about Buzz Sawyer? I said, was Buzz Sawyer a tough guy? And then Jerry, tell the story that you told us.
He was a damn bully. I mean, I won't go into the story because this family show here, but
we're a dysfunctional family show though.
I like Buzz. I mean, I never, you know, I never disliked him, but I always thought he was bully. He was a Ole Anderson wannabe. And, but in the ring, he had no cardio at all. I mean, he was a tough guy for probably 30 seconds. If you give me 45 seconds with him, his tongue will be hanging out of his mouth and he's throwing up in the corner. And I got documentation. So he was a bully. If a guy would let him push him around, he would go to extreme with him. But if the guy would bow up against Buzz, he would cower down like the biggest sissy in the world. And yeah. But I, like I said, I was a friend of Buzz, but I'm telling you the truth. He was not a tough guy. He was a bully. I mean, there's a lot of guys that get tough guy reputations because they are bullies, because they pick their spot and they pick the guys that they want to be tough guys with and bully around. But, you know, even the bullies know you can't mess with some guys.
Well, because Jerry is a gentleman, he will not reveal the quote that he said. I will just say that when he was asked, that Jerry said, when referring to Buzz, the word that rhymes with the word grunt, he referred to Buzz as, let's just say, the word that rhymes with grunt. But Jerry, we were going to get you out of here in time for your NFL football. Hope you got the Red Zone channel, my man, so you can watch all of them. Yeah. And we do appreciate your time. Thank you so much for joining us, Jerry, talking about your career and your brother Jack's career.
Well, a pleasure, guys, and have a great day and happy Thanksgiving to everybody out there.
Same to you, my man.
Thanks, Jerry.
See you.
Barry, always a pleasure to talk to Jerry, especially not only about his own career, but about the legendary career of his brother, Jack.
That was I am a kid in a candy store. And I got to tell you, Jeff, I don't know how many interviews we've done. I'm going to assume we've done somewhere 30, maybe a little over. Maybe, yeah, maybe even more. Maybe 40 interviews.
Some would say that we've interviewed more people and more well-known people than any other show on the Arcadia Network. Boom! Mic drop.
I like it. And I was going to say any other podcast at all, as far as wrestling. Not even just on our network, which I think is accurate. But at the same time, I just think overall. But I got to tell you, that right there ranks as easily one of my favorites. I would say it's top three. Right off the bat, I hung on every word. I am thrilled, Jeff. We have to have him back.
Yeah, you know, he's, again, just an incredible fountain of knowledge about the wrestling business, a guy that is a go-to source. I just wish he had been more open about what he really said about Buzz Sawyer. Great. So, all right, let's move on to other things. Barry, a couple quick topics to throw at you. Saw this one on Twitter, and because we are such big fans, Barry, I'm going to ask you to pick, give me your all-time most annoying Seinfeld character. Like, let's say not like, you know, George or Kramer and like that, but like your minor Seinfeld characters that you would least like to be stuck in an elevator with. Go.
Absolutely. Do you remember the guy that owned Farfel, the drunk on the plane that owned Farfel?
That's right. Yes.
I hate that fucking episode, and I hated that guy. Do you remember the episode when Elaine was working for Jay Peterman and the woman kept calling her Susie?
Yes.
I hate this woman. I have no idea who she is, but I can't watch this episode when it comes on. Other than that, because those are my two, Maybe Marcelino. Do you remember Little Jerry, the cockfighting episode?
Yes.
Didn't like Marcelino either. If you're looking for a character that's maybe a little more fleshed out than maybe just one or two episodes. I don't know. Susan, I guess I could say, but everybody hated, you've heard that story. Susan was basically written off the show because everybody hated her in real life. Yeah. They hated her. They didn't like her character. Susan offered nothing to me. It was a great distraction, but, I just felt.
Well, as Jerry said so famously in the show, in that episode, I don't know that he likes her a lot as much as he likes it.
There you go. Right. Understand. Understood. Yes. Sure.
Something I think we all can identify with. So yes, I was going to go at first impression. You made some good choices here. I was going to go Uncle Leo.
See, I like Uncle Leo, though. I can't.
Hello, Jerry.
Yeah, your cousin Jeffrey.
Yes, that's a guy. Never saw cousin Jeffrey, and I think it was great that we never did because it just allowed your imagination. It's like Bob Sacamano. You never saw the guy, and it allowed your imagination to run wild about what the character must really be like.
There, Jeff, right there is a whole episode. The imaginary friends of Kramer that we never saw. He had a few.
Exactly. So anyway, next, I want to ask you, Barry.
Is that it for you? Is it only
one? Just say Uncle. No. I mean, I'm not going to go because I said name the character, characters. And you decided to just go freewheeling with all these episodes of Seinfeld that you don't like. So next, saw this posted elsewhere. Barry, if you could go on a road trip with any three guys in the history of the wrestling business, you're going, say, from Tampa to Miami for a show, and you get to be in the car with three guys. Who are you going to name?
Ooh, so I like this question. There's two different, I guess, thought processes here. One is which Barry is this? Is this the Barry right now, or is this the Barry in his early 20s? If it's his early 20s, that means I'm looking for a party vehicle. If it's the Barry right now, I'm trying to be a little more, introspective. And where can I get the knowledge? So I'm going to go with the one right now because that's where we're at. I am going to say Eddie Graham because I would hopefully be able to pick a brain and get some answers off of that. I would go with Harley Race because I think as a kid growing up, Harley Race, and this was something when we had on Roop actually, and we talked about Harley Race. Everybody respected Harley Race. There was even the fans. He was a bad guy, but he had the ultimate respect. So I'm going to go Eddie Graham, Harley Race, and then who would be the third? And there's a million choices right here, Jeff. I'm going to go Jack Briscoe. I will go, since this is a Jack Briscoe intensive episode, I think the conversations that would take place between the three of those, if I just shut my mouth and listen, I will leave that car and my wrestling IQ would have gone up 10 full fucking points.
I'm going to agree with you on Jack Briscoe. As I said, one of my earliest wrestling heroes. I'm going to go with another of my earliest wrestling heroes, Bobby Shane. And then the third guy was also mentioned by Jerry, and that's Cowboy Bill Watts. And because Bill Watts was always one of those guys that I wanted to have at the dinners that I was never part of a dinner with Bill Watts. I don't think they've ever had Bill Watts at any of the subsequent dinners, lesser dinners now that I was not involved. I'm sure that Pretty Boy Doug Summers was a great replacement for Bill Watts. But anyway, so I will go with Jack Briscoe, Bobby Shane. Did I say that? And Cowboy Bill Watts. I think that would be a real, like you said, just sitting in the backseat, listening to those three guys talk. I think you really would gain a vast knowledge of professional wrestling from those three individuals.
That's a great question, though. And I think, Jeff, that is one that you need to get in the Breaking Kayfabe with Badger and Barry Facebook group.
We will post that. I think we'll get some interesting responses. Okay, so Barry, the other day, I'm out with the lovely Mrs. Bowdren. We're listening to Sirius XM and the 80s channel. And the legendary VJ Alan Hunter is on there, and he talks about a song came on. I'm going to tell you what song in just a second. So he said, the 80s to me can be summed up in one word. And he used a word that, quite frankly, somewhat surprised me. So I'm going to ask you, Barry, morph into your inner MTV VJ mode. You can be Mark Goodman. You can be, Nina, what's her name?
Well, I remember when I was a VJ back in the 80s.
Maybe smoked a few cigarettes, that one, I'm not sure. But sum up the 80s in one word, what would you say?
Now, am I summing up my 80s or just the 80s in general?
The 80s in general. We know what sort of dark path you're on.
Exactly. Yeah, anal, right? That's where we're
giving or receiving? Because wait a minute.
Well, it was the 80s, Jeff.
Fave on something here.
Yeah, it was the 80s. You know, anything?
Isn't it yet?
I'm gonna say innocence.
Really?
Yeah, but I'll tell you why. Can I tell you why?
No, I'm going to tell you why that's a remarkable answer, because that's exactly the answer that Alan Hunter used, was innocence. Yes. And I was like, what the fuck? You're talking about the 80s? And this was right after he played the song by Kim Wilde called Kids in America.
Yes.
Okay. Just, I have to tell you, I'm not a huge fan of a lot of remakes. They did Kim did a remake of the Supreme song, You Keep Me Hanging On, which is one of the few remakes that I actually really liked. But Kids in America is playing. Alan Hunter came on, was talking about, he goes, you know, the 80s for me, the word that sums it up is innocence. What makes that extremely interesting is that apparently the 80s channel is starting their own podcast about the 80s and, you know, different pop culture things and stuff like that. But what was great was here after he just said that the 80s could be summed up by the word innocence, he said, okay, we're going to be talking about the 80s, the decade of decadence. I'm like, right. Well, quite frankly, you're got your yin and your yang there, Alan. But anyway, so please continue. I interrupted.
That's another fantastic word. Decadence would be another one. I think with the 80s, I think what happened was, again, I'm giving you a perspective. We're roughly the same age. We both lived through the 80s. The 80s for me was the great transitional period. It was that was where a lot of things really happened for me in life. And I think when the 80s, 1980, 1981, there was a real innocence to what was taking place. By the mid 80s, I think things had started to change a little bit. I think a lot of it was AIDS. You know, when I first moved to New York, Jeff, and when somebody says, how was New York in the early 80s? It was incredible because it was pre-AIDS. And really a lot of, especially when you were my age, I was, in my late teens and early 20s, that was everything to me. And by 84, getting into 85, the thought of, if you put your dick into something, you could fucking die. Like, it wasn't just the fear of going to the doctor and getting a shot or some sort of medicine. It was the fact that if you had unprotected sex, you could die. Like, that was really fucking sobering. And I think a lot of people now, especially as, younger people, they didn't know anything different. They were just taught, you want to use a condom because AIDS can kill you. You certainly don't want to get somebody pregnant. But for us, we had to completely change the way we operated. And that was really fucking frightening at the time. So I do think the first half of the decade is innocence. The second half of the decade might be cautious. I love decadence. Because, as I'm saying innocence, at the same time, the proliferation of cocaine, especially to us who did live in South Florida.
When he was talking about innocence, I was like, did this guy ever watch an episode of Miami Vice?
Right. Exactly.
So, you were talking about, the possibility of you stick your dick in something and you're going to die. I will tell you a story. I don't think I've ever told you this story. When I began dating the woman that would eventually become my first wife, she who shall not be named, the date that we broke bread, shall we say, for the first time was in. You remember Dan Dowd's?
Yeah, yeah. Steakhouse?
The giant cow out in front.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, our first entryway into adulthood, there's a nice little euphemism, was in the parking lot of a Dan Dowd's.
Okay? Nice. In front of the cow?
It was off to the side. We did have a couple walk past that I'm sure was very curious as to what was going on in the backseat of that 1967 cherry red Firebird. But anyway, so we had had described as unprotected sex. But you mentioned that, of course, you're worried about dying. But oh, yes, there's always that fear of pregnancy. And what happened was after that session of unprotected premarital sexual activity, she was late. Now, mind you, when I met her, she had just, she was, I love talking about this. I started going out with her when she was pregnant with somebody else's baby, Barry. And oh. so Did I ever tell you that? Yeah, that was
no.
that was interesting times. I was young and stupid. What can I tell you? You know, nothing like introducing your parents. Ah, this is my new girlfriend here. Yeah, that's somebody else's kid that she's carrying.
How far along was she?
She was like, she was a cashier when I was a manager at Toys R Us. She was about 5 months. She had the good bell swell going on, no question. Yeah. So anyway, so she had the child, okay, and so we were engaging in our premarital sexual activity. So anyway, what happens is she ends up being late, okay? So now, of course,
she's already pregnant, right?
No. This was after she had the kid.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
So now. The first time we have the unprotected premarital, oh my God, it's going to happen in front of Dan Dowd's, and she's late, okay? And I mean to tell you, Mr. Bowdrin is sweating bullets.
Sure.
You know, and I'm just like, what the fuck? And so then a couple weeks go by, and she hasn't said anything to me about it, and I'm like, anything you want to tell me? Any news developing? And she's like, what are you talking about? I'm like, you know, has your friend shown up in town yet? You know, all the different euphemisms that you can use for that. And she's like, oh, yeah, no, it happened like a week ago. You think maybe that's info I could have used?
Yeah.
So she chose not to tell. Yeah. So,
go
figure the relationship didn't end well.
Did you have relations with her while she was pregnant with that first child?
I did not have what you would call penetratable relations.
All right.
We had relations of another kind, I will say. Her parents almost caught us on the couch having those sort of nature, oral nature, if you will, Barry. It was good times. But yeah, the sweating of the bullets for 2 weeks while she didn't bother to tell me that her friend had showed up in town a little delayed was very fun. I don't know how we got off on that tangent, by the way. So let's do the smooth transition from having premarital sex of an unprotected kind to let's talk about this past week's AEW. It was a very, very smooth transition. I'm sure you'll agree, Barry.
Oh, yeah.
Nothing like it. So, Barry, I thought, comparatively speaking to the last 2 weeks, this week's AEW was really, really not good at all. First of all, tell me what your thoughts were.
Yeah, I got it.
Fell asleep.
And that's what it was. And I told you that I actually fell asleep during the episode. What I got from it, I really enjoyed this tag team Top Flight. I thought their match against the Young Bucks was a really good match. I really, you know, the Young Bucks get a lot of hate. I'm sorry, I'm not part of that camp. These guys, every time they get into a ring, I their matches are decent. This Top Flight tag team, it's two brothers. I believe they're from Minnesota. One is 19, one is 21. I mean, you know, when was the last time you saw a 19 and a 21-year-old at the level of professional wrestling that these two are already at? Like I was kind of blown away. I do feel the rest of the episode went downhill after that. So I think my big contention, and this will be twofold, was the week before, a week or 2 weeks before, MJF had purchased tickets for the Inner Circle to go out to Las Vegas. And so two thoughts about it. First is, you know, Vegas, for the most part, is essentially shut down beyond belief. There are some people out there, but for the most part, Vegas is a ghost town, as much of the country is. But Vegas especially is a ghost town. So it seemed a little ridiculous that, you know, even the densest person watching the show probably realized, you know, there's nothing happening in Vegas right now. The second aspect is, we're getting a lot of these vignettes that are really self-indulgent. Now, again, I'm not a Jericho hater. There are a lot of Jericho haters. There's a lot of AEW haters, and I don't really fall into that camp. But, you know, it's almost week after week at this stage where we're getting these vignettes that are just really overly self-indulgent. If we go back to Jericho's 30-year anniversary, which again, that match, which was Dr. Luther Serpentico versus Jericho and I think Jake Hager, but I don't remember correctly. I think that was the worst match that they've had on television maybe ever. And it was just, but it was a one-off. Okay, that's fine. But then you're doing this whole dinner and song and dance routine with Jericho and MJF. But I could almost excuse it in the sense that if you're going to stop right there, it's bizarrely interesting. But now we're seeing this on a weekly basis. And I got to tell you, I don't know if this is doing anybody any favors. As a one-off, as a two-off, possibly even a three-off, it's fine. But it's weekly at this stage, and it doesn't make any sense to me because I think it's definitely overkill. And I see the ratings, Jeff. I got to tell you, bizarrely, their ratings look to be going up. I want to say they did close to 1 million people this past week. I want to say I read it was like 954,000 or something similar to it, which might be one of the highest ratings thus far. But God, it was a terrible episode. And then the main event, and I like Ricky Starks a lot, and I like Brian Cage a lot. I just, you know, having Will Hobbs turn heel, it makes me question a lot of the booking philosophy of AEW. And again, I don't want to get on that because a lot of times these decisions are made. And look, we only know a small portion of what we know. We don't always understand everything that goes into making a decision like that. But as somebody on the outside, you know, you've barely developed this character, Will Hobbs. And my understanding of professional wrestling was if people are going to buy into a turn, whether it's a babyface turn or a heel turn, the person in question has to be over, whether hated, loved, whatever it is. They've got to be over to some degree. Nobody gives a shit about Will Hobbs. And that's not a knock on the guy. It's a knock on the fact that his character gets 5 minutes of airtime every 2 weeks, and we've only seen him maybe four times, and every time it's really small. I don't know if he's ever done an interview because I don't remember it, but the character hasn't been fleshed out. So what do? They just turn him heel. Doesn't make any sense to me. So I think AEW, it's we've talked about it, Jeff. You brought it up last week or the week before. You know, Cody, a lot of this is a vanity project for Cody. And I got to tell you, for the most part, I do like the fact that Cody is not in the world title picture any longer. I believe that was one of the conditions when he lost MJF or Jericho that he would never challenge again for the world title. But when AEW comes on television, the first person shown in that graphic is Cody Rhodes. And I like Cody for what Cody is, but let's not push Cody for any more than what he truly is. At the same time, you've got some great talent here. There's great talent in AEW. You know, it's I guess the Lucha Brothers are now going to be baby faces and feuding with Eddie Kingston and Butcher and the Blade. But you're pushing talent, and I believe this talent is being pushed and put at the forefront. And it's all based off of either egos or trying to make somebody very happy when you've got guys that are better. And those guys aren't seeing the same kind of airtime. And I think this is an issue that AEW truly needs to look at. Will they look at it, Jeff? I don't know, because if the ratings are saying that they're not doing anything wrong, why are they going to change something? But in the long run, is this going to turn around and bite them in the ass?
So, you know, one thing I think that apparently based on, you know, what you've been saying is that one thing Cody learned from his dad was just because you're not the world champion doesn't mean you can't be in the main event, because even though
yes,
he's not wrestling for the world title, he is on the main event of that show. And let's talk about how ridiculous it is that his wife does this skit where she, quote unquote, breaks her arm or breaks her hand. And a minute later, Cody's in the ring. Apparently, he doesn't give a shit about the fact that his wife's backstage selling the broken arm, broken hand, whatever. And that's just a waste of airtime, by the way. That whole putting his wife on the, you know, we've discussed that infinitum. And, you know, I don't have anything personal against what is obviously a beautiful woman. It's just,
no, not at all.
Wow, right. She does not belong in any way in that spotlight. And to me, time that she spends on the air is time that could be given to Vicky Guerrero or time that could be given to Dr. Britt Baker, people that have their character has begun to get established. Tell me how Brandi Rose is friggin' as established, you know, as either one of those two. Also, the Vegas thing, which I called the Hangover skit because they were trying basically to reenact the movie The Hangover, was just, you're absolutely right. It's kind of a vanity project. And, you know, I really like Jericho, and you know, he's been one of my favorite things about the show for the past year. But, you know, one of the things I've noticed in the last couple of weeks is, you know, all of a sudden Jericho, and I'm not talking anything about his physique or anything like that, Jericho's starting to look old. You know, like all of a sudden his facially, he's looking older. And, you know, this is a guy that on the microphone talking about a match is absolute dynamite, and a guy that they should you know, how they have like Excalibur or anybody, you know, when they have, and really Shivani and Ross, you know, Shivani should take like perfectly good, you know, spot like in the ring doing interviews or segments or whatever. But to me, it's just, you're having too many guys in control of the microphone. And if you want to have a guy in there doing color, have Jim Ross with somebody like Jericho, have Jim Ross with Eddie Kingston, have Jim Ross with, you know, Taz. But, you know, if you got too many cooks in the kitchen, the meal's not going to turn out right. I'm sure that was some sort of euphemism my grandmother used to say. But so, yeah, I was very disappointed in this episode. You're right. The opening match was very strong. I give the Bucks credit because here's a young team that realistically not a lot of people have heard of. But they gave them a lot of this match and really made them shine. You made them look great. And you have to give credit to the Bucks themselves for not wanting to go in there like some people would have done and just destroy these kids in 30 seconds. You know, who are these kids? I'm not going to give these kids any spots in the match. But they gave these guys a good competitive match. And kudos to the Bucks for that. The young kids on Top Flight showed a lot of potential. I think they still need some rough spots that need to be, you know, smoothed out. But I think potentially they really have found a good young babyface tag team that can definitely be worked into the promotion. So yeah, I will hope this week's show certainly is much better. So as we begin to wrap up, Barry, we received some sad news that I want to address within the group from our friend Benji Fido, and that is that his son Antonio, who Lord knows has been through a lot in his life, a lot of medical issues. Benji revealing that his son had been born, I want to say something like three and a half months premature. And, you know, with this a kid now in his teens at age 13. And, you know, Barry, I don't know if you remember what it was like being a 13-year-old, but boy, 13-year-old kids can be really cruel. And I saw that with my own kids growing up and what they had to deal with in school. And, you know, when especially if you're a kid that had a medical situation, so you're smaller than all the other kids, you know, and you have these physical struggles that you're going through. I'm sure all those kids in school are completely understanding of all the issues that Antonio has. So Antonio is going to be going through some medical procedures to see about some problems that he's having. So on behalf of Barry, myself, and Barry, I'll let you speak on it. We want to wish Benji and his family, and especially Antonio, all the best in his upcoming physical trials and tribulations. And go out there, and we wish you the best.
Yeah, I take this really to heart. I love Benji. I love Antonio. What they've been through, you know, we'll never fully understand the pain that family has probably been through and the love that they have for Antonio. And I called Benji that day and we talked about it. And, you know, it hurts me a lot. It truly hurts me a lot. But at the same time, I'm always positive and I want to stay positive and I want to believe that Antonio's going to be fine in getting through this. And at the same time, I want to offer my support to Benji and his family. And I know the brothership. And I got to tell you, you know, Jeff, and we've said it before, when we started the podcast and then started the Facebook group, I don't think we had any idea what it was going to morph into. And it's a support system. It's, you know, not only do we talk about how crispy do you like your bacon and, you know, and irrelevant, you know, fun, meaningless shit. But at the same time, you know, we talked about somebody's sister last week that was undergoing, I believe, breast cancer. And we faced, you know, in the group, Jeff, we faced the death of spouses. We faced your own cancer battle. We faced a lot. And people are there to support. And it's amazing. And I'll tell you what I really find amazing about it. A, these aren't empty words, because I know when I, you know, when I spoke to Benji or when I speak to you, people will reach out privately and not even publicly say anything. But then when we post this publicly, people that we don't even know, like people who lurk in the group, offer support and they offer whatever they can. And it, that's the legacy. It's not my shit stories. It's nothing else. The legacy, if the podcast was to end today, and it won't, so please don't read into that. If the Facebook group was to end today, our legacy, Jeff, is how the brothershippers support each other, how people are there for each other in these really shitty fucking times. And that, to me, that's everything. That is unbelievable. And I don't know if there's any other Facebook group. I can tell you, Jeff, I admin four different Facebook groups. I don't know if I have ever seen, whether it's a group I admin or just that I'm a member of, any group that will show the love and support of what the brothership does. And that right there, everybody listening right now to that should feel eternally proud, because that to me it's so fucking important.
Well said, my friend. And so that will just about wrap up the show. I would encourage you to follow me on Twitter at Bowdrin Jeff. I want to remind the folks out there, I posted in the group, I think about a week or so ago, I have a new supply of the books, Breaking Kayfabe, Dinner with the Legends of Wrestling, and also They Call Me Booker, available for the holiday season. So if you're interested, reach out to me, excuse me, on Facebook Messenger and see if we can hook you up in time for the holidays. Barry, you think that's about it, my man? We're about ready to go?
Yeah, this was a, you know, I love all of our episodes, but I got to tell you, I really fucking love this episode. this is one, I don't know, you know, we're just before Thanksgiving. We should say happy Thanksgiving.
Absolutely.
This is 2 days before the holiday. And Lou, why don't you join us, Lou? Let's discuss between the three of us right here. Jeff, because you've got your daughter, you've got your son, you've got your son-in-law. Are you doing a big Thanksgiving? I'm not. It's going to be me and my immediate family and our dogs having Thanksgiving, but no grandparents this year. As Zach has come home from college, you know, we are going to keep him separate from the grandparents. We're not doing much. You've got a large family. Are you and Lou doing anything special?
Lou?
Just getting together with my sister who lives nearby and my niece and my soon-to-be brother-in-law. It's just going to be a small, intimate dinner.
Will you be having turkey, or will you be going full Californian and having a vegan Thanksgiving?
Oh, no. Oh, no. It's turkey.
Well, I'm only going to say that living in a state where it is now against the law to gather in groups larger than six, Barry, Kiaze Fiazabe on the Fiazamly, if you know what I mean. But we want to wish everyone out there in the Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry and Lou universe a happy, healthy, happy Thanksgiving. Enjoy time spent with family. Limited to a group of six, no bigger than that, Barry. That's what the government's telling us. So that wasn't political, was it? No, I don't think so.
No.
So we will see you next week, folks. Have a great holiday.
Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network.